Succession number 28528, Reel 16.
Mr. Tony Paulson, Reel 15.
My officer signed the rest of us to crouch beside a hedge and then enter the house, while he took me to reconnoitre the other side of the house. As we went round the corner, there was the spit and crack of bullets flicking past our legs. So we dived back into the house to find the others had picked up a good number of prisoners who surrendered without much fight, having been cowed by the shelling. There was a good all-round view from the house, and I was sent up to a first-floor room to watch out with another rifleman for any artillery targets. He was taking a turn at the window when I suddenly felt an urge to join him. As I did so, there was an ear-splitting crash beside me, with blood then streaming from my foot and arm. There wasn't any great pain, just shock and surprise. Someone bandaged my wounds and carried me downstairs. From there I was piggybacked down the hill to where we had left the trucks and driven to the field dressing station. There I was expertly patched up before being sent to a Canadian hospital in Rome. That was the start of a long journey. The ulnar nerve in my arm was shattered beyond repair, though my foot healed well enough. So I was no longer of military use and was put on the hospital ship Orangi at Algiers, which docked at Liverpool after another quiet voyage. I suppose I was fortunate, but I did not think so at the time, as I remained keen to rejoin my company. When I was recovering from appendicitis, I had been pleased to find I was on a list of those urgently required back at the front. It was even more encouraging to find that I had twice more been urgently requested before finally being listed as unfit for further combat. When I had landed at Bone 2 years earlier, I was a raw amateurish soldier, but very hurt to be left behind with the baggage, as if I was the man A Company could most easily spare. That depression and sense of rejection deepened when I was delivered to the HQ cookhouse rather than A Company. I never won any special medals other than service ones, but these lists were and remain what I regard as honourable mentions. I gained a promotion in the elite company, as I regarded it, of the elite battalion of an elite armoured division. To that I could now add these positive proofs that I was respected and wanted by that company. For me, that was the height of achievement and a happy reversal of that earlier seeming rejection. So I could indeed sail home with genuine pride in performance of a dangerous and difficult job. Well done. Perhaps I did indeed do as well as I could, or as was expected of me. It's become despite his injuries, Dick became a postman on return and was able to do that job happily for many years, as his leg at least had been properly healed. It has become common to denigrate the Italian campaign as poorly fought and as an unproductive sideshow. Happily, the facts tell a different story. The leading historian of the war, Little Hart, commented that relative to the forces involved, Italy tied up more German troops than on any other front, particularly in relation to the forces available to oppose D-Day landings. That was a worthwhile achievement in itself. Hart added that it also made a major contribution to German overstretch and consequent collapse, even though he himself had not been in favour of the campaign. The previous chapters also made the previous discussions have also made clear what exceptional defensive advantages the Germans had with the succession of mountain and river barriers and strongly fortified lines from the Gustav to the Gothic. There were also those millions of scary and lethal mines. They were a huge bonus to the Germans as they retreated from the toe of Italy to the Austrian border. As the Allies were always on the attack, they were of no value to them. Against such strong fortifications and competent soldiers, military logic expect the attackers to suffer the greater casualties. In Italy, the reverse occurred. According to the recent study by the Sorbello Institute in Perugia, there were 435,000 German casualties, over a third more than the Allies' 300,000, which is a good indication of who fought the better. That was then confirmed in the final battle starting in April 1945. By then, the Allies were through the Gothic line, and it was a straightforward fight on the plains of Lombardy. Both sides had equal numbers of troops, 600,000 each, according to Little Heart, though we were unquestionably had the better weapons and better air support. Yet within a few weeks, the Germans were overrun and so shattered that a quarter of a million or more surrendered on 2nd of May, days before the general surrender in the rest of Europe. According to Hart, that also had a special significance as the only such surrender while Hitler was still alive. For us, it was something of an achievement to have twice forced the surrender of such huge numbers. The main achievement remained, however, the vital assistance given to the Normandy invasion. For that, the Allies were limited in the initial numbers they could use, since no more could be transported by sea or air. Had the Germans had another 500,000, including several armoured divisions, to deploy in opposition, D-Day might well have been a disaster instead of the close-run thing it was. One who had no doubt about the success of the Italian campaign, especially the final overwhelming defeat of the Germans, was Winston Churchill, whose idea it was. This was his message to Alexander on 29th April 1945. I rejoice in the magnificently planned and executed operations of the 15th Group of Armies, which are resulting in the complete destruction or capture of all the enemy forces south of the Alps. That great final battle in Italy will long stand out in history as one of the most famous episodes of the Second World War. Might have been well earned, but his prophecy could hardly have been further from the mark, as VI Day, or Victory in Italy Day, was as soon forgotten as the Italy campaign was when it was operating after D-Day. Another of friends whose battle experiences I managed to get from them was my special friend at Winchester College, John Weir. As an example of how seriously training was taken at Winchester. In 1937, I was in a winning recruit cup for those in their first year of training at the college, and drill cup, that and drill cup were much prized awards in inter-house competition. And warlike by nature, it surprises me to be reminded by photographs that I was in my house's winning recruit cup squad of five. It was then a surprise that we won in view of the fact that I sliced my wrist while fixing bayonets and still have the scar to prove it. Even more of a surprise is to see myself with two stripes and sitting next to the sergeant in command when B House won drill cup in 1939 on the eve of war. The sergeant was John Weir, my closest friend. With his brother, we went shooting on Solway Firth one winter holiday. The beautiful sight of the geese flighting in against the cloudless sky particularly impressed me, but I was not much of a threat to the birds. Indeed, I was at a greater risk to myself, and on one occasion managed to get mud in the end of my shotgun, which promptly exploded at the end when I fired. That trip put me off shooting for good, but merely enhanced the pleasure John took in it, sometimes to an obsessive degree. As a break from firing at Germans in the battles for Italy's Monte Camino, he even went shooting duck and geese on the now drained Garigliano marshes. So absorbed was he in their pursuit that he wandered on until he found himself being shot at too. In the battles for this mountain, Mount Camino, we're fought beside the Moroccan goons of the Free French Corps, ferocious mountain fighters. Most unusually, they have left a plaque in Casino to commemorate not their own exploits, but the skill and courage of their British comrades. Shortly after, it was the Goumiers who were deserving of a very special commemorative plaque. In the massive battle that then erupted from Monte Cassino to the sea, it was hard going all along the front until the Goums breached the Gustav line by stealing through the Aurunki Mountains and appearing in the Germans' rear. Close by where I was, the noisiest and most lethal weapons of destruction of the day thundered around us. By contrast, they broke the Germans' nerve and punctured the impregnable Gustav line by silent stealth and expert use of their knives or small arms in the dark. Their pay was just 4 francs a day. Initially, they had the added spur from the French of a bonus for every German ear brought in. That was rapidly stopped when they found not to be too particular about whose ear they presented for their money. Indeed, the Goums, if they had no plaque, at least they entered into army slang. The verb to goom came in future to mean to go further and farther than anyone could possibly have expected you to do. Not long after Camino, John was killed in the Anzio beachhead. That was particularly upsetting for me, as he'd been such a fine friend. He had captained the soccer 11 in which I played and been outstanding as a dashing forward in Winchester's own peculiar version of football. The time and the manner of John's death made it the more distressing. By then he was a major in the Scots Guards, and the battalion had just been moved to a rest area to await being shipped away from Anzio and reorganised after its multiple casualties. As a long-serving officer, John qualified for return to England and an eagerly awaited marriage. Often a barrage of shells only causes few casualties. In this instance, just 3 strays were devastating. The first wounded an officer. As several others ran to help, 2 more hit the trees beside them. That turned the shells into lethal airbursts, which instantly killed John and 4 other officers and mortally wounded the commanding officer. The Scots Guard history records how good an officer Major Weir had been. John Weir was probably the best company commander in the brigade, it records. Much earlier, he had been wounded in Africa near Marith. Within a fortnight, John was back leading his carrier platoon in 3 exceptionally successful patrols. These netted around 50 prisoners, gathered crucial intelligence, and prevented the mining of a key road, for all of which Weir was awarded the MC. The 2 of us were not far apart when 250,000 Axis troops surrendered in Tunisia. In his report on that campaign, his commanding officer's comments included, "The outstanding officer of the battalion is John Weir, who is absolutely first class with his carriers." But the final judgment upon an officer is what the men think of him. When he was killed, their comments for the family were equally effusive, as the letters his then fiancée, let me read, amply illustrate. Right flank company mourned John's death to a man. Many have I heard, old soldiers too, say that he was the best company commander they ever had. His sergeant's letter was in the same vein. Many of the platoon spoke to me of how they admired and liked your son's firm but friendly manner in the way he treated officer or NCO or guardsman alike. The letters then included a couple of interesting comments. Not only at Anzio did such an even-tempered man show, only twice at Anzio did such an even-tempered man show anger in those letters. The first was at the pathetically incompetent early leadership of the American General John P. Lucas, who was only sacked after condemning them to extended suffering in the narrow overlooked confines of the beachhead. In his final letter home, there was also a blast against the BBC for broadcasting that the war was nearly over when it had not come to its bloody climax. As he commented, it is hard enough to maintain everyone's morale under the terrible conditions here. Telling us the war is nearly over makes that doubly difficult, as it undermines the normal willingness to take necessary risk. Nothing ever undermined his own willingness to do that. Another of my sporting friends at Winchester, who made a considerable impression in the Anzio fighting, was Ronnie Taylor. And this is his account of his earlier fighting and of his battles there. In Tunisia, Ronnie fought alongside our 6th Armoured Division with 24th Guards Brigade. He and his 5th Grenadier Guards Battalion particularly distinguished themselves in the final month of bitter battles to capture the hills on the northern flank and open the way to Tunis. This is his description of a preliminary encounter. To disrupt our offensive, the Germans attacked after dark on 21st April. A regiment of Hermann Göring blasted through the forward screen of 1st Battalion Duke of Wellington's regiment and lit the night with burning transport from the gun line. The Duke's CO arrived at midnight at our HQ in the cave on Grenadier Hill. He was unruffled. "The enemy are through my battalion. When you have seen them off, my chaps will come to life again and hit them as they retreat." 25 tanks followed behind the infantry, but all attacks on our position failed. Soon after dawn, half those tanks were destroyed by a squadron of Churchill tanks, perfectly sighted in hull-down positions, and the rest fled. That left a mass of infantry stranded in the valley bottom behind our HQ. Our Vickers machine guns fired 58,000 rounds, our mortars 1,000, and the artillery shelled continuously. The carnage was terrible. About 500 Germans downed weapons, climbed the opposite side of the valley, and surrendered to the surprised but delighted 1st Battalion Loyals. We then kept pushing forward daily to close in on our main objective, the formidable Jebel Bou Oukaz, only some 4 miles to the east of the menacing dark bulk of Longstop Hill, where 3rd Grenadiers and 2nd Coldstreams had fought so brilliantly months before, only for the hill to be lost when handed over to the Americans. Oukaz was a similar formidable obstacle. The attack had to go in over 2 miles of open cornfields. then 3 miles of hand-to-hand fighting over the broken ridges and wadis. We were on the left, the Irish on the right, the Scots guards due to come in and take over the final peak. The start was not propitious. The brigade commander planned a dawn attack in which the guards were well practiced and very effective. The corps commander, an artilleryman, insisted on a broad daylight assault to help the gunners and a proposed bombing attack, which in fact did no damage to the defences. The brigadier refused and was sacked on the spot. He then said, "I'm the only officer who can conduct such an attack. I will do it and go thereafter." So a distinguished career of 26 years lay in ruins, and we were condemned to an unnecessarily bloody battle in which we took all our objectives, but at great cost. The Scots Guards took the final peak, but could not hold it against heavy counterattack. Our casualty count steadily increased as we had to hold our part of the hill for over a week against constant attack from our open flank. On one occasion, my company commander, Christopher Ford, and I set out on a sniping expedition. When tucked in behind rocks, we were fortunate enough to be in a perfect position for enfilade fire on a German attack against the Irish. I was filling the magazines for Ford, who became so enthusiastic he kept firing at such a rate that in the middle of the 14th magazine, the barrel melted. My subsequent rifle fire was not equally effective as his Bren gun had been. The peak was finally taken to coincide with the 5th of May breakthrough attack, with the way to Tunis now finally opened. After the Axis surrender, Taylor and Ford were put in charge of a prisoner of war camp set up on Tunis Racecourse. The number processed by this camp alone was 176,000. Which makes the overall estimate by Eisenhower and Alexander of 250,000 prisoners seem modest, rather than over the top, as many historians now claim. There was even tougher fighting ahead for Ronnie in Italy. The most demanding and most vital being a last-ditch stand to save the Anzio beachhead. His first experience of the Anzio battle had not been encouraging. At the briefing conference, he recalled, an ancient little man with pot belly and pebble glasses stood up and said, "I am the general commanding U.S. 6th Corps. We are to land at Anzio. Now I will hand you over to my G2, who for sure knows a hell of a lot more about this than I do." Later, John P. Lucas visited each guard's battalion and did nothing to restore confidence by saying, "I have never handled an important battle like this before. It's certainly going to be an interesting experience." The only experience he had was from the depth of a dugout and then being sacked. By then, the damage was done and our troops surrounded and overlooked in a very narrow beachhead. No wonder Churchill commented sourly, "I wanted a wildcat flung into the Auburn hills. All we have is a stranded whale still on the beach." Inevitably, the Germans soon launched a major attack with superior numbers and words from Hitler that if they drove us back into the sea, they would all get special medals and leave. On a pitch black rainy night, they swept through 2 guards battalions to take Bon Riposo Hill. All that was then left between them and the sea was the guards HQ and the gun line near the beach. In that HQ, there were just 3 senior officers, including Ronnie, each managing to muster a section of 6 men in support. There were only a few 100 yards between them and the hill from which the Germans came charging on in column. In what followed, there were echoes of another memorable defence in Italy, this time of a bridge in Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome, recording Horatius and his 2 companions saving Rome from Lars Porsena's attacking array by holding the bridge. Ronnie took the central position in this attempt and to keep the ditch, and the query, if you think of the lays of ancient Rome, who will stand at his left hand and keep the ditch with him, was Bill Sidney, later Lord de Lisle. In this action, he was to win an exceptionally meritorious VC. This is Taylor's account of the desperate defence. We had several pieces of good fortune. Our HQ was in a disused quarry, the gully, completely hidden. We were dug in on its lip. Only a few yards ahead was a largely man-proof obstacle, a ditch 15 feet or so deep, with dense thorn bushes either side, and a few feet of water at the bottom of its now slippery slopes. Unaware of the problems facing them, the Germans advanced shouting and firing Spandaus laden with tracer bullets, which showed they were firing well over our heads. When they plunged into the ditch, we just kept lobbing in grenades, which proved to be the perfect weapon, and of which we had a limitless supply, as the gully was where all the reserve ammunition was stacked. The one weakness in the position was a shepherd's track across the ditch opposite Bill Sidney and his section. Such Germans as found it in the dark were mostly shot down as they emerged. The few that survived were ferociously hunted round the bushes by a lieutenant and a sergeant with lethal effect. As it got quieter, we could hear the German company sergeant majors gathering up those who had managed to scramble back with shouts of "Fünfte Kompanie, kommen Sie hier! Sechste Kompanie hier!" and so on. They made two further attacks that night. In beating them back, Sidney was wounded three times. When the third assault was imminent, he was carried face down on a stretcher to his post, where he continued to slaughter the enemy until they gave up. No VC was better earned. Clearly, Sidney was the Horatius who bore the main brunt of the attack and deservedly won the main accolade, but everyone fought brilliantly to beat back the massive assault, including Ronnie in his spurious Lartius supporting role. So he continued to do in the long slug up Italy, which we all endured. But for him, it was never quite as bad, he recalls, as the first 20 days at Anzio, when they lost as casualties 27 of their 33 officers, including three commanding officers and all six company commanders. Another friend of mine, not related to school days, but to my work days, was John McGavin, who was my personnel boss at Reed International. This was something that was a surprise to me, because during the whole time I knew him at work, and we lived close together in Sevenoaks, so we socialized often as well, but I was totally unaware of his taking any part in the war, let alone that he had won a meritorious MC. Indeed, so unaware were the majority of the Reed paper group, people with whom he worked, that I only knew when his obituary was published recently, and which listed him as John McGavin MC. And someone rang me up and said, "Could you tell me of what John, in particular, of what John was master of ceremonies?" So clearly he hadn't spread his military cross around very widely. For the millions of civilians turned into unnatural warriors by Hitler's imposition on us of total war, its impact remains indelible. Many of those who survived were physically or mentally scarred. Many still do not wish to talk about it. Others, like myself, wonder how we endured it or survived it, but are happy to reminisce. Others prefer to remember the comradeship, which is why so many reunions thrive. One common factor for all is that the memories remain so vivid, because nothing makes more impression on the mind. Thank goodness we were spared the modern army of counselors, who could not have begun to cope with one day's fighting, is more of a threat to the nerves than the small incidents that now seem to be thought worthy of counselling. I also find some pleasure in watching war films and thinking, did I go through that? How nice, I won't have to do it again. As mentioned, in actual war, we try to create the absurd pretense that it was a rough game, and to bandy comments like, bad luck, you were in reserve and missed the fun. But watching the celluloid characters and phantom